services for client identification. And I'm going to begin with a very simple example. So assume you have a form spammer that is pushing, say, herbal supplements at an online web forum. Now, in a perfect world, a standard response to this would be to have a security association with each one of your clients. And this security association would map down into an individual user. And in order to revoke access to a misbehaving client that's, say, you know, pushing herbal enhancements, that you would push an IP, or you would revoke access. Unfortunately, this isn't the use model of the internet today. Rather, access control decisions are often realized on an IP level. So, for example, as an IP filter or an IP blacklist. Now, many people decry this as a very bad approach, and for good reason. It's quite common that the public IP address that is used by our spammer would also be shared with an innocent victim, and thus denying access to the innocent victim. So let me speak a little more generally. IP addresses are used for client identification in a number of capacities. As in the example I just showed you, they're used for blacklisting, which is revoking access. They're also used for whitelisting, which is providing access. So I used to work at a national laboratory, and whenever I went on travel, if I wanted to access lab resources other than just HTTP, but you know, if I wanted to SSH in or if I wanted to use my mail, I would go to a web page and I would authenticate. And once I'd successfully authenticated, they would punch a hole in the firewall from the IP address that I was coming from. Now, this suffers from the same problem as in the previous example. If I shared this IP address with, say, half of Vietnam, we'd give access to half of Vietnam to these relatively sensitive computing resources. And if I shared it with an attacker, you would give the attacker access. So IP addresses are also used heavily in content localization. And this is, for example, for targeted advertisement. Like, Adult Friend Finder wants to find you kind of friends in your area, right? And this should be local to you. You also use this to determine the default language. And so if you appear, based on your IP address, to be coming from, say, Germany, they're going to try to use the German. And IP addresses are used for compliance issues. So if I'm in the UK, other people, I can serve content for people that gamble in the UK. I can't do it in the United States. And so I'm going to make a decision based on where you appear to be coming from on whether or not to serve you this gambling content. In all of these cases, proxies, NATs, and DHCP really limit the accuracy of my ability to make decisions. And it's very easy to find instances online where IPs are indeed used to determine locale, for example. So while I was making these slides, I took Google and I pointed it to a coding server, which is a CDN out of Princeton, in Switzerland, which I guess bounced me to Spain, and then Google gave me the Spanish default website, even though I was sitting in Mountain View, California. So at a very high level, I do think we as a community really understand that there's a problem here, and we definitely use it to motivate our research, and we use it when defining technical solutions, but it's not so clear we actually understand the depth of the problem. And this is the focus of this talk, and this is the focus of our research, is to really try and illuminate the effects that NATs and proxies have on server identification of clients. So we want to know, what are the properties of NATs, proxies, and DHCP on the internet today? How do they affect a server's view of its clients? And hopefully, if we can gain an insight, we'd like to gain an insight that would allow servers to make more informed decisions in the future. So that's the ultimate goal of this work. So this is largely a measurement work, and we use the web as a measurement platform, and I'll describe why we chose to do that in just a minute. So we did a lot of measurement, we collected a lot of data, and then went through an analysis period. And as a result of that, we feel like we've come up with another method that will inform server decisions. And so I've kind of very roughly split up the rest of the talk into these three sections. And I'm going to start with our measurement platform. So unfortunately, asking questions like these is pretty resistant to traditional measurement techniques. As I'll show later, about 75% of all hosts are behind a middle box of one kind or another, either behind a NAT or a proxy. And as far as I know, there's no technique to actively probe clients and enumerate clients behind a NAT or a proxy. Now, there might be funny configurations where, say, you do port forwarding per unique client, and you can do some IP ID tricks, but this is really not the norm, right? The majority of these don't do any forwarding at all. You terminate at the addressable endpoint, which is going to be your NAT or your proxy. Another approach could be to use client-side measurement. Like, I develop some binary, I do a /.post, you download it, you run it, it gets a lot of local information, and send it back. Unfortunately, there's a huge deployment hurdle here, right? And there's been very few instances where, you know, say, humble researchers like us can actually get very, very massive deployment that would give us something that's statistically significant. So kind of fortunately, while you've been busy with other things, your browser has developed into an incredibly sophisticated active content engine. And so, you know, the browsers that you're looking at right now can probably execute, you know, 5 or 6 different languages, right? Not just HTML, but JavaScript, Java, Flash, ActiveX. And more importantly, these languages, they're full-features languages, and they've got incredible access to power and local configuration state, for example, the network configuration, where you've been, your locale, your time zone, and so forth. So the idea is, in fact, quite simple. The idea of this measure is we want to use existing web traffic. We want to develop an active content that we can grab local configuration state, send it back to us, and analyze this to understand what are the extent of NATs and proxies on the internet. So to do this, we need clients. And we use 2 approaches to getting clients. One of them is we bug existing web pages. So I'm going to describe, you know, in the next few slides, some scripts that we developed that will get information. And these can all be loaded from within an iframe. So if you wanted to help me do the measurement, I would give you this bit of HTML. This HTML you'd put in your website. This is a 1-pixel iframe. It's transparent to the client. And in the background, it will redirect the client to our web server, which will then go ahead and serve it the active content, which will execute in the background. So this method takes advantage of existing web pages with existing clients. The second manner was to use Coral CDN. So my co-author, Mike Friedman, developed Coral CDN as the maintainer of Coral CDN. So for about every 1,000th client that goes to Coral CDN, say they're requesting some page, they get redirected to our measurement server. We give them the active content, they execute it, and then the active content will actually redirect them to their original location. So both of these rely on redirection and gathering information. So I'm just going to go through the web bug step by step and tell you about the information that we gathered. And this is very, very similar to the way that we did it with the CDN. So say a client goes to a web page with our bug on it, and they request the default page. The client sends it back index.html HTML, and it's got our web bug in it, which causes, in the background, the client to go to our custom web server, which we built, which does some network trickery to gather some information that we call Navajo. So just from the initial HTTP request, we're able to get quite a bit of information. We can get proxy headers. So a lot of proxies will tag like a via header or an exported for header. We can get the user agent string, and so the user agent string is the operating system of the client, right? So this is sent by the browser. But we can also get the SYN fingerprint, which can derive the operating system of the TCP termination point. So if I make a TCP, if I'm going through a proxy, this will reveal the operating system of the proxy as compared to the client, which is the user agent string. We can also get the TCP RTT. Again, the RTT is from the termination point. So if it's a proxy, it's not going to be from the client. We can get cookies to identify unique clients. And then we used a commercial-grade geolocation engine on the public IP address provided by Quova to get the public location. OK, so the client requests the iframe. We send the iframe back, which is loaded with all this active content. And we wrote 2 scripts. We wrote one in Java and JavaScript. So the Java can grab the local IP address from the machine, so the machine's local IP address. And if this is a routable IP address, then we can go ahead and use Quova to divulge the local location, right? And we can also get the local ephemeral port, and we can compare it against the public port. And if this is being translated, again, that's an indication of a middle box. From the JavaScript, we can get location cues such as time zone and language. And we can, since JavaScript can work in an asynchronous model, we can kind of do these asynchronous pings at the application level and get a round trip time to the client. So now we've got a round trip time at the network level and a round trip time at the client level. Of course, if these differ, then there's a probability that there's a proxy in between. And the information once collected is sent back. So we ran this measurement over 7 months, and we measured about 7 million unique clients. By the end of the measurement period, we're getting about 2 million requests per day. In order to proliferate the bug, we emailed a couple of mailing lists asking people to put it up, and the response was pretty phenomenal. And so we had, by the end, about 32 third-party websites that put our little HTML iframe up. Very few of these administrators we actually knew personally, and the range of content that they covered was pretty diverse. We had, you know, e-business solutions. We had a child's TV show. I think it's called United SpongeBob. We had punk rock videos. So on top of that, we also had 2 of the 3rd hits come from Coral, and the type of content that Coral serves is extremely diverse. As far as geographic and logical coverage, we did the geolocation again using Quova here, but we got hits from 214 different countries with heavy coverage in the US, Japan, China, most of Europe and South America. And as far as routable prefixes that we'd covered, it's about half of the advertised prefixes by route views. So it's quite a bit of information. Okay, so we collected this information over a period of 7 months, and then we wanted to analyze it. And at a very high level, about 75% appeared to be behind middle boxes. About 60% of clients came behind NATs, 15% behind proxies. And then we looked at DHCP reallocation speed. So for the analysis, I'm not going to go into a lot of the details, but I just want to kind of provide a high level of our approach. So I'm going to look at the NAT sizes, the proxy sizes, and then how fast DHCP is reallocated. In order to do this, this requires us to be able to differentiate between, say, a NAT and a proxy. And the way we did this is first we kind of made our little bin of proxies. And to determine if a host is a proxy, we used a number of techniques. The first one was just like, okay, do you have a common proxy header? So it seems like about 80% of proxies were actually tagged via header on it. Another thing is we look at the SYN fingerprint to indicate if it's a common proxy, like NetApp and Netcache have very, very unique fingerprints. Another one is, so say you're a client and you download our JavaScript. The JavaScript is our JavaScript does a GET request back to the server. However, it forges the host header. And then the host header says, okay, you know, give me access to google.com as the host. Now, if there's a proxy that's HTTP 1.1 compliant, it'll actually go to Google and get the request. If there's not a proxy, it'll go back to our server. So based on whether or not it was able to get the Google page, then we knew whether there was a proxy in route. On the other hand, we could determine if a host is behind a NAT if, say, the SYN fingerprint matched the OS. There was definitely a middle box on the way because we have the local IP address, and it was not otherwise classified as a proxy. So the first thing we looked at is NAT sizes. And to kind of predicate this discussion, I'm going to kind of refresh how DHCP works in a lot of these common appliances. And so most modern equipment that you buy, like you go buy that Netgear for your home network, and it allocates DHCP normally starting from a known address. Very common one is 192.168.1.100. So this is the starting address. And for every subsequent client, I'm going to allocate you a new IP address, right? And these are linearly and monotonically increasing. So if you look at a histogram of all the NATed private IPs that we looked at, and so this is what the private IP space is. So if you want, you know, people map out the public IP space, here's what the private IP space looks like. We map it out for pretty much every private IP range. And so just so I know you can't read these. This is the 192.168.0, this 192.168.1, and this is the 10.0.1 range. But one thing that should jump out at you is at these default ranges, you got these extremely large spikes, right? These are very apparent. So what we did is we gathered from every NAT that we got information from, we plotted a histogram, we got these large spikes, and because these addresses are allocated linearly in almost all cases, this should give us some indication of what the sizing or the distribution of the sizes of NATs are. So let's kind of like home in on one. So this is 192.168.0. 192.168.0.100 is a pretty solid allocation. I think it's from Netgear. If you take the discrete derivative of this, it will show you the relationship of the NAT sizes for each one of these. So it looks like NATs of size 1 are about equivalent to NATs of size 2, 3. And this is plotted on a log-log scale. So actually, these NAT sizes decrease exponentially. And so this is very much in line with our experience. So we got many requests from NATs. 60% of all clients became from NATs. Almost none of those clients, less than 1%, actually showed multiple clients coming from the same NAT. And so while this is a heuristic, it is in line with our experience. We think it strongly suggests that NAT sizes, for the most part, decrease exponentially in size. Now, we did find a number of quite large NATs. We found one in Japan that looked like it was a Class B. We found one in China that looked like it was assigned to Google that, you know, had hundreds of clients in it. But these were, you know, in the order of tens, something that we could track just by looking at, like, the diversity or the entropy and user agent strings from the IP. So the implication is NATs are primarily small in pretty much every metric we used. And in 99% of the cases, it appears that there's less than 10 hosts. Proxies, on the other hand, are another story. So many, many proxies that visited us would have multiple clients visited up at the same time, a large percentage. And these proxies appear to be very large. So this, for example, I believe is the Google web cache or web accelerator. And it appears to be servicing essentially half of the globe, as far as we can tell. Oh, by the way, we used Quova to get the location of the client IP address. And this isn't an isolated instance. So we identified about 100,000 proxies. Here's the top 15. They have international coverage. The clients come from many different continents, and they can be very large in size, certainly, you know, tens of thousands of hosts potentially. So if you compare proxies to NATs, so unfortunately, if we just look at NATs, we've got very few cases where there's actually multiple NATs. Very few cases. But if we just look at those cases, which is less than 1%, and we compare that to only the cases of proxies where we saw multiple clients, it still appears that the distribution of proxies is larger. Proxy sizes are larger. So this is the CDF of the number of unique clients we saw between NATs and between proxies, but we're only considering the networks which we saw multiple clients. So we've already eliminated 99% of the NATs here. But even then, if you're talking about 10 clients, you know, very few NATs, less than 2% of the NATs had more than 10 clients that we identified, where you know over 30% of the proxies do. And finally, this is just kind of little distant metrics. We used the geolocation, the distance, to show that you know within the 75th percentile, clients are over 10,000 kilometers away from their proxies. So in many cases, the clients are actually quite far away from the proxies based on the geolocation information that we had. So proxies tend to be quite a bit larger. The clientele is very diverse. They're geographically diverse. And as a first-order approximation, if you're going to worry about something, you probably want to worry about proxies. Finally, we looked at DHCP reallocation. We use a very simple technique of cookies to see how fast DHCP got renumbered. And now realize we're not doing this from a client perspective. We're doing this from a server perspective. So the question is how often will a client's IP change? And we found that if you were to blacklist an IP address from a client over a two-week period, in over 95% of the cases, you'd affect maybe two addresses, most likely one address. And in very, very few cases would you affect more than that. So the numbers are somewhat similar to that. So DHCP renumbering is pretty slow on these timescales. So I just want to kind of summarize. So it appears that most clients are behind NATs or proxies, and about 75% of the ones we measured. NATs, which are 60% of the clientele we saw, tend to be quite small, and this was just in line with the number of unique clients we saw becoming behind NATs. Proxies, which served about 50% of the client, came from all over the place. They serve many, many more hosts than NATs. And on a relative scale, again, DHCP doesn't seem to be a phenomenal problem. So to further validate this, I think this is the last graph. We took all the proxies and we put them in one bin, and then we took all the IP addresses and we put them in another bin, and we asked the question, okay, so if I was a server and I was going to make a decision, I was going to blacklist an IP address, how many IPs or how many unique clients would it affect? So generally, for the internet at large, it would affect two or more clients 10% of the time. For if it was just a proxy IP, it would affect over 50% of the clients. And for all public IPs, this includes proxies, 2% of the time it would affect 10 or more. For proxy IPs, it would be 20% of the time, right? So like the collateral damage for making a decision on a proxy is not minimal. Okay, so what? So now we want to make a decision. We want to use this for something useful. And we say, okay, a good first order approximation is to go ahead and try and detect proxies. And how could you use this to your advantage if you're a server? So one reason, if you're going to make a whitelisting decision and it appears someone is coming from behind a proxy, you might simply decide not to make that decision. On the other hand, if you're, you know, there's one form spammer and maybe, you know, once a day he's pushing his herbal enhancements, you may decide not to go ahead and blacklist it because there could be wide coverage behind it if he's coming from behind a proxy. Or you may require some very heavyweight form of authentication, just require all users that are coming behind it to also have to do this heavyweight form of authentication. So now you're introducing a usability hurdle at the cost of not denying access to a number of clients. So before I go into the methodology that we've developed, so where this is all going is we've developed the methodology to detect proxies in real time by servers. But before I get there, I just want to talk a little bit to the universality of these numbers. And so, I mean, this begs the question, is like, do these numbers represent the internet as a whole for all time? And the answer is very resoundingly no, it doesn't, right? So like technologies are going to change, new technologies are going to be adopted. We didn't cover the entire internet. But there's two insights that I would like to get across in this talk. The first one is that the web is turning into an extremely rich means of executing content, and it can be leveraged in ways that can give us insight into the edge. And the edge has, until now, been very, very difficult to kind of get at for researchers. And the second one is there's a number of methodologies that we use, which I'm kind of glossing over now, but I really encourage you to read in the paper, which a server could use to enumerate the properties of its clients if it has, say, a fairly static clientele. So as a result of this, we've come up with a number of technologies that we've analyzed. And I'm not going to go through the analysis now, but we've analyzed and included in the paper for detecting proxies in real time. And the idea is, okay, so I'm a web server, and I want to make informed decisions on what I'm going to do with an IP address. And so as clients come, I'm going to execute this level of tests, and then it'll tell me not only if there is a proxy with some likelihood, but where the client might be if it's not where it says it's going to be. And as a result of the odds, we feel that this actually has relatively high accuracy and a pretty low false positive rate. So currently we're integrating this into a commercial IP intelligence system. So we're working with a company called the company Quova, which gave us the geolocation information. So they sell you a server that servers use. I mean, it's used all over the world, that if you get an IP address, they'll tell you the geolocation. This is a pretty standard thing. And they also try and tell you a little bit about the network characteristics. Oh, this is going over a satellite link. This has this bandwidth. This has this link capacity. And so we're instrumenting their server so that it'll also try and detect proxies and give you some properties of the client, whether they're far behind the proxy or whether they're near the proxy. And so it works very similarly to the way our measurement works. I'm just going to step through it pretty quickly. So you've got a web server. The web server has the little bug on the iframe. The client gets the page. They get the iframe back with the page. Because of the iframe, they go to our Illuminati server and request the content. And then we get the HTTP stuff like we did in the measurement. The active content executes. We get the results. The results are sent back to an IP analytics engine, which goes over and does the analysis. And it checks the RTTs, it checks the local time zone, it looks at the SYN fingerprint, it looks at any history we save to detect very large proxies. And it stores, with this IP address, and actually with this session ID, a number. So if I'm client, my session ID is X for this session, then the server now can say, okay, tell me whether IPX is behind a proxy. And if it says yes, it can also actually estimate the location of where we are. And it's just this very simple constraint satisfaction engine that we're building. Oh yeah, so it can grab the session ID. So they're planning to bring it to beta in the next 2 months. And so we think that if we fill over the summer, we're gonna actually get a lot of experiments running this in very large and high traffic sites. So let me just go ahead and wrap up. IP addresses aren't the best method of enforcing access control decisions or identifying the client. And I think this is very clear, and I think this is well known. However, it's likely that they're going to continue to be used. And in fact, it's very prevalent to use to base decisions on these. So on a relative scale, again, NATS and DHCP appear to have relatively low impact. And so if you make decisions with these, you may be affecting 2 hosts, you may be affecting 10. But all the exceptions where you have, for example, large NATs, you can archive it. Proxies tend to have relatively high impact. And so we think kind of the best first order approximation is detecting proxies to kind of better and improve accuracy. And if I had time, I actually kind of wanted to go through these. So this is just fun anecdotes. I'm a big fan of anecdotes. So a cool thing about proxies that NATs don't have is if I'm a proxy, I can multiplex multiple clients, right? So you have one proxy and there's a lot of clients behind it. Another cool thing about proxy, you can have one client that uses multiple proxies for an anonymizer. And we uncovered like a ton of anonymizers here. And what you do is the people that were using the anonymizers, they'd maintain their local IP address. So for this example right here, we've got one class C, which is located in the eastern United States. We've used anonymizers around the world, right? They appear to be coming from all sorts of different countries, but they had all the same local configuration state and the same local IP address. Another pretty interesting anecdote that we uncovered is there's actually like a really large usage of reserved address ranges. So I'm not talking private, I'm talking reserved, right? So say, I'm some ISP in California and I decide to use the range 1.0.0/24, whatever. And then IANA decides to go ahead and allocate it to somebody else. So now my clients can never communicate to them because you've got this local resolution, you've got this aliasing problem. And unfortunately, it tends to be actually relatively prevalent. We've covered a number of networks that use these. Okay, so I'm going to open a question. Thanks.
Hi, Amin Vedat, UC San Diego. It's a very interesting talk, very interesting data. I was wondering if you had any information about the network characteristics, RTTs, bandwidths, loss rates of hosts that might be behind NATs, proxies versus the ones that are connecting directly.
So we did an analysis, and unfortunately the data is relatively messy, but it turns out that you can find so if you go through a proxy, the RTT is much, much slower, right, because you're doing application level transactions, that's for sure. And NATs don't tend to affect the RTT very much. That's for sure. As far as when proxies are concerned, as far as detecting the RTT of the network level versus the application level, in most cases you can actually do it. However, I mean, you've got these high variances on both ends. So we found that this is a discriminator. We can find, you know, maybe 10, 15% of the proxies this way.
But do you find anything with respect to binning of available bandwidths or RTTs for clients? So I might, as a first order blush, characterize hosts that are coming from behind NATs, certainly the ones that are coming from small NATs, one, two, three hosts, as being behind cable modems or DSL lines, and they might have different RTT and bandwidth characteristics relative to the ones with direct connections to the network. Have you seen anything like that?
Well, so this isn't something we looked directly at, but I think I've got two answers. One of them is, I mean, it appears that there's pretty large ISP NATs in China and Japan, and they've got characteristics that look like a university here.
But in those cases, there are many more than one, two, or three hosts coming from those.
That's right. In the cases where there's very few, these are most likely. So, I mean, we did a separate study for another paper where we were just looking at link speeds from end hosts due to code red, right? And we found that the vast majority, 80%, were sitting on behind NATs and had these very low link speeds. And so it suggests that they were coming from behind cable modems.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Justin Kappos, University of Arizona. You mentioned DNS blacklisting as sort of a motivation for this. So I'm curious if you looked at how many externally visible mail servers that do SMTP actually use proxy servers or share external NAT addresses with clients that are also behind the NAT.
So SMTP specifically, no. So this measurement was just about the webs. And so just to be clear, I was mentioning IP blacklisting, not DNS blacklisting. So we don't do any resolution of the names. But we didn't do any studying for as far as like spam, for example.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you.
I also had a question about the blacklisting claim. So on the previous slide, you said something about DHCP not having a big impact. And if I understood that correctly, I think you were saying something about the dynamism of the addresses introduced by DHCP won't have a big effect, say, if you wanted to do some kind of IP-based access control or blacklisting. You mentioned spam
right.
as a motivation.
So this is form spam. So right. actually, let's step back. There's a couple things said. One of them is you may be able to sidestep the blacklist, but I was a little more interested in collateral damage. That is, if I want to blacklist something, I want to make sure that I'm preserving innocence.
Right. Oh, okay. So I think. I mean, the previous question was also about DNS blacklists and spam. So, regardless of whether you're talking about web spam or
okay.
email spam, so there's an adversarial component to this too, right? And actually, you know, some of the things we've seen in our measurements is that the clients on large dynamic address pools can just pick a new IP address, right? So, when you say DHCP has relatively low impact on effectiveness of
well, so wait. So
I'm wondering.
I want to make sure. I want to make sure I'm clear.
Well,
I want to make sure I'm clear of the question. So, if I'm behind a local, if I'm behind on some sort of private address and I request a new IP address, this is equivalent to the server. Now, if I'm on, and so actually I don't know the locality on large ISPs, but it's quite possible I get the same IP address. So you may be able to.
Go ahead. I mean, not necessarily, right? On a LAN, it's very easy to. You know, steal another IP address on the same,
yeah, sure.
same subnet. Right?
No. I mean, there's no argument on a LAN. I mean,
BGP route hijacking. We've seen it, right?
Right. So maybe I wasn't clear. I don't think this is a panacea for like solving the internet ills for the loose binding of IP addresses
right.
to users. I do think that today, servers are making decisions on IP addresses, and they're doing it relatively uninformed.
Right.
So,
I mean,
in the capacity that we can make decisions on those IP addresses, it would be nice to know a little bit about the network layout. Now, is it simple to get by this? It's actually very simple. I mean, a good technique is just to pretend to be a proxy, and then you get all the services afforded to a proxy. However, if you're not colluding with a proxy, and I make a decision only to whitelist you if you're not behind a proxy, you'll find this very difficult. That is, if I have some accesses. If I have some resources, I only want you to access me if you're not coming from a proxy. You'll find this is very difficult to do unless you're actually colluding with the proxy, right? This is, for example, a law of physics thing, right? I know my round trip time to the proxy, And so if you're far away from that, and I know my round trip time to you, unless you're colluding with a proxy and you know the information about the proxy, so I mean, it certainly raises the bar in these contexts.
Okay. Yeah, my question wasn't so much about proxies so much as, you know, I mean, I buy the fact that sort of DHCP may not introduce a lot of dynamism, but if you're dealing with the adversarial case of, you know, trying to evade blacklisting, it may be a slightly different game.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
John Mark Agosta, Intel.
Hi.
If I'm a worm adversary, can I use your techniques to discover IP addresses behind a proxy and build a hit list before I enter you, before I enter into your network?
Well, I mean, if you were a worm and you're going to enter in the network,
I have to do scanning to do that.
I would just scan, right? But
well, I want to avoid scanning because that can be detected.
The answer is yes, if you can gain enough clients to get you, but I think there's probably like passive ways or ways to better do this. Unfortunately, we require the clients to come for us. So like say you set up this huge measurement platform, you go to FARC and you go to Slashdot and you like post things and people come to it, and then you get enough, then yes, you can get actually a very granular view of the networks behind proxies, it turns out.
Okay, thanks.
So can you comment on whether client, you mentioned this just a second ago, whether clients opt in or are you surreptitiously adding?
No, admins opt in. So it's actually a very interesting.
Sorry, you said websites opt in. The question is whether the end client.
No, the answer is no. So something that we've learned that if you want to get like.
Sorry, can you comment then on what the ethics of installing spyware on my computer is?
No, okay, well let's go back. So that's a good question. So we stayed completely within the security model of this. So when you go to Gmail, you're opting in to go to Gmail. You execute about 65,000 lines or so of JavaScript. They have logs, and if you go to any website that has Google Analytics, it tracks a number of things: your location, your user agent string, how many times you've gone there, what your search terms were that referred you to get there, right? So I think that there's somewhat of an implicit contract that when you go to a website, that whatever's on the website, you're going to execute. And we didn't do anything subversive. So we could have actually been a lot more clever about divulging information, but we stayed explicitly within the security model. So now, I guess it's open to debate whether you think that this, the amount of information we got over server logs was pretty minimal, like if you actually went to the server logs, and this is pretty public information. Thank you.